Welcome to Mental Health Uncovered, a show dedicated to having candid, everyday conversations about mental health. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the episode. Welcome back to another episode of Mental Health Uncovered. This is Seth Showalter, your host, and today I have the privilege of interviewing Will Harrison. Will Harrison is someone that I met online, and I have the privilege of interviewing today. And one of the things we're going to focus on is his mental health journey. So, Will, to kind of kick this off, fill me in. How are you doing today?
Today, I'm doing pretty well. My wife and kids had the last 2 weeks off because she's a teacher, and they had the 2 weeks off for break. So it hasn't been as busy as it usually is. So it's been good to have some time to just relax, not get up as early for work, and just kind of start the new year with a little self-care.
Hey, I'm all about that self-care. It's so incredibly important. Well, as I mentioned, part of our show is all about talking about people's mental health journey and how they got to where they are now from where they were before. So to get started, can you tell me a little bit about what life was like for you growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a rare condition called Möglius syndrome. And Möglius syndrome is quite rare. It affects, the statistics are kind of all over the place, but it affects roughly a couple hundred thousand people around the world. It could be more, but, you know, due to not being able to assess what things are like in other parts of the world, we don't really know how wide-reaching it is.
Sure.
So I grew up in rural South Carolina, and to give you a little idea what Möglius is, so in utero, my facial nerves never developed, so the 56 cranial nerves didn't develop. I can't smile, can't make facial expressions. The first thing that people really notice when they meet me is probably that my eyes, my eyes are kind of they're formed in toward each other because I have a cirrhosis. And also they'll notice the speech. So I have a hard time pronouncing certain letters like P as in pineapple, B as in boy, because I don't really get full lip closure. I grew up in rural South Carolina. I grew up with my mom and my grandparents. My dad left when I was 3, which is something I think that once that happens, you never really get over that. It's something you're kind of always working through throughout life because, you know, here's your mom, but where's your dad? I had a lot of surgeries growing up. I had about 20 surgeries in my first 20 years of life. I'm now 41. I faced a lot of bullying in school. I didn't meet anyone with this condition I have until I was 29, so I went 29 years without meeting anyone else with Möglius. And another thing that would become pretty important is that I grew up in SBC church. And for us, church was everything. You know, I was there Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. So for me growing up, everything revolved around church.
So church was really important. Do you think that was church important because of your mom and kind of the family, or did you find that interest in church on your own?
No, it was a family thing. So it was a very small church, nearly 100 people on a good Sunday, and it was the whole family. We were always there. I think that as I got older, I took a lot of interest on my own. So when I say I was 100% in, I was 100% in to probably the 1930s.
Wow.
The other thing I wanted to point out is that my mom married my stepdad when I was about 8 or 9. However, my stepdad had a lot of issues on his own. He was an alcoholic, verbally abusive. So I grew up with this shame. He would come home, he'd yell at you. And so you're getting bullied at school, but in a way, you're also getting bullied at home. So, I had that going on for many years.
Sure, sure. And so your dad left at 3. I can only imagine what that's been like. Have you ever been able to reconnect with your father? What's that relationship been like throughout the years? So is it just gone, or like what happened there?
It is just gone.
He did
reach out. Well, I should say his girlfriend at the time reached out a couple of years ago. Nothing really prepares you for someone wanting to come back into your life when they've been out of your life. At that point, it was really 40 years. And so I had a lot of emotions. Mm-hmm. Do I connect with him? Do I not connect with him? And from what I could tell, I never messaged him directly. I did message his girlfriend. And from what I could tell, I don't know his heart. I don't know what he's thinking. But I couldn't really tell why he wanted to get back in touch after all these years. And I think for me, that was more important. You know, are you wanting to do it are you really wanting your relationship? Or is it just something that you feel like you need to do because you feel guilty? So I never was able to figure that out. And I still haven't.
So he did. So hold up. So he did try to reach out?
His girlfriend at the time did.
His girlfriend.
Yeah, he never reached out directly, but his girlfriend did.
Okay. Gotcha. And how did that resolve? Because I bet that was pretty triggering for you.
I told her I wasn't ready.
I'm really proud of you for that.
I agonized over it because Susie was saying, you should come down and meet him. He wants to meet you. He wants to meet the grandkids. And I'm like, you're counting my kids, your grandkids. But you never did a part of my life, no less their life. And so I think that kind of made me really weary. And I just said, you know what? I can't do this right now. It was during the COVID, and there's a lot of other stuff going on. And I just wasn't ready. And I don't know if I ever will be ready. You know, I don't think anything really prepares you for facing something like that.
Well, I think that there is a path of forgiveness to go down, but it takes a lot of work and it's hard work, and we have to take our time, and no one is rushing you, and don't ever feel rushed. But if you start to feel like you're holding resentment in your heart that's keeping you stuck, then that's something to explore. But until you're ready to do that, don't allow anyone to force you or push you, okay? Because I can only imagine what that's been like for you throughout all this time to go without a father. And I'm so sorry to hear about the disorder. I mean, it sounds like it's affected your life in many ways. And can we talk a little bit about how you've coped with this condition?
Yeah, absolutely. So growing up, One of the dangers, I think, of spirituality and one of the dangers among a lot of evangelicals is the ability to hide our feelings, the ability to over-spiritualize our feelings, and the ability to spiritually bypass what we're feeling and thinking. And growing up, I was kind of seen as, oh, here's this kid who has this disability, but he loves Jesus. And I don't think no one ever really showed me how to identify my emotions with that. I would go around the different churches and share my story, God made me this way. But at the same time, I didn't really know who I was. And so I think that part of the issue at that point was I didn't know about the negative feelings of just the anger, the frustration. I did feel a little bit of that as a teen, but I kind of suppressed those emotions. And so it's taken a lot of years of hard work to say, hey, you know what? On the one hand, I don't regret being going this way. But on the other hand, there are a lot of challenges, and there have been a lot of challenges throughout the years.
Can we talk about what some of those challenges have looked like or what some of those challenges have been?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first challenge I had was dating. I think that when you are someone who's different, you really delete, at least for me, I really deleted for a long time that I was unlovable. that no one would ever love me in that way. And I believed that really until I met my wife. And so I went through my whole high school years and college years wanting to date, trying to date, not really knowing how to date. And it wasn't until I met my wife, and I never had a conversation I had with her, because she knew that I just did not trust easily. And she had to say, "Will, I love you for you." And even after we got married, I would ask her, like, "It's not hard living with me who's different." And she said, "Will, no, I love you for you, and I always have loved you for you." So I think that coming to accept that it can be challenging because on one hand, you know your spouse loves you, but on the other hand, you know that you're different, and you know that for years you faced that rejection. And on the other hand, when I had kids, we are five now, when I had kids, I remember trying to prepare myself for the day when that conversation would come up, "Dad, you're different." And I think my oldest son was about six, and he said, "Dad, how come you can't smile?" And I had this long explanation. I got like three words in. He goes, "It's okay, Dad. I love you." And that's just how it's going for my kids. I think one of the neat things about it is I've been able to really teach my kids about diversity and helping them understand that everyone should be treated equal, and everyone needs to be loved and accepted.
So dating has definitely been a challenge. What else has been difficult?
One of the other challenges I really faced early on was getting a job. So I'm now a clinical social worker. That's another part of the story. But my undergrad degree is in Bible and youth ministry. And when I graduated, I interviewed at an organization in Atlanta that did a lot of cross-cultural youth ministry at the time. And I remember going into the interview, and the interview went really well, and I never heard back. And so, 2 weeks later, I called, said, "Hey, just want to follow up, what's going on?" And the guy literally said to me, he goes, "We're not going to hire you because people can't understand you. We're afraid that people won't be able to understand what you're saying when you talk to them on the phone." And that just kind of floored me. But then again, I was only in my early 20s, so I didn't really know how to process that. And they said, "Well, you should probably just go work in the church." I'm like, "Okay, fine." So at that point, I just wanted to do whatever it took for me to be successful. So I got an internship in a church out in Colorado and moved out to Denver. It was supposed to be a year-long internship, and I got 3 months into it, and they just decided to end it. It really gave me a reason why. It just ended. And I think what was hard for me at that moment was I never knew if it was because of my disability, lack of knowledge. But what was hard for me is that I was, at that point in my life, I just wanted to be a sponge. I wanted to soak up things around me. I wanted to learn. Mm-hmm. I wanted to grow. Mm-hmm. I knew I didn't have all the skills. I knew I didn't have all the knowledge. I just wanted to learn and be mentored. And that didn't happen. So, moving back to South Carolina at that point, and just went through a long period of depression, what I now know to be depression. But at that point, I didn't have any words for it. Eventually met my wife and moved to Michigan a couple of years later.
So it sounds like communication has been a challenge as well. And that's impacted you in getting a job. In what other ways has difficulty communicating resulted in difficulty in your life?
I think communication, a lot of times people will just, you can for example, with someone you don't know, you'll be having a conversation, and they'll just totally misstate what you're saying. And, sometimes it's worth to try to correct it or say, "Hey, I meant this," because sometimes you just go with it and ignore it. And there's times, I think I've learned to laugh at this point, because I realize if someone really wants to get to know me, they will get to know me. If someone wants to have a conversation with me, they will have a conversation with me. And There are times when it's been kind of funny. I remember around the time my first son was born, I was at Costco getting chicken breast, and I asked the lady, I said, "Where's the chicken breast?" And she goes, "Why do you want my address?" So I think there's times when I do laugh about it, but I think there's times I try to over-communicate to people. Sometimes I won't use certain words because I know that those words will be hard to understand. People have a hard time understanding those words. So yeah, there's a lot of conversation, I think.
Is that something that can get better, or is that pretty stagnant? I'm just curious due to the condition.
I think it's stagnant. I don't know how to use that word. I think I would just say it's where I'm at, mm-hmm. and I'm okay mm-hmm. with it. It doesn't, you know, for me, it does get frustrating at times, but I don't let it get me down. Don't get me wrong. Right. There's things that are definitely hard, but I think that overall, I don't live in those moments. I know now where my worth is. And I think once you know where your worth is, you just move on.
And it's so critical. Understanding your worth and value is so incredibly important. And I can't stress that enough. And it sounds like you've really taken steps towards developing a really good sense of self in order to be strong. And it sounds like you've been through some very serious challenges that have made life difficult, that have forced you to essentially form a sense of self that can withstand. Another word that we might refer to that as would be resilience. I would consider you to be a very resilient person given your challenges and what you've been able to overcome. Looking at that, you mentioned that you are a social worker. I am as well. Tell me a little bit about your journey into social work.
That's a really cool journey. So after Bible College, I eventually moved to Michigan, got married. I spent 7 years working at a retirement home doing housekeeping. Still, at that point, I think I still wanted to be in the industry really bad. So I kept on thinking I need to be in the industry, So but one of the things that I had this early on is when you grow up in a bubble, you really don't know how to relate to people who aren't like you. And what those years did for me, it really helped me form friendships and relationships with people who weren't like me, like non-Christians. And I got to know them for who they were and found them to be absolutely amazing people. And even to this day, I'll say that, you know, I've had some good jobs. What I love the most are the coworkers I've had. I've had a lot of amazing coworkers throughout the years. So we have several kids with medical needs. And during my daughter, who's now 9, when she was a year old, she had cleft palate repair. And during that surgery, there was some complications. So afterwards, she was rushed back into surgery due to some bleeding and spent that week on a ventilator in the ICU. And so that was just a really traumatic experience for my wife and I. But I remember in that week thinking, you know what? I really want to work with families. And I had been thinking that a little bit before. But a couple months later, we were meeting with a friend, and she said, "Will, you really should consider going into social work." I had never, you know, I was in my mid-30s at the time. Up to that point, it never crossed my mind about this field. You know, you hear about it, but when you hear social work, that was in a negative way, like CPS or even obviously, food stamps, you know. So people really don't know what social work is. So on the way home that night, I looked at my wife and said, "I'm going back to grad school." She looks at me, she goes, "No, you're not." And the reason she said that is because I'm not a go-getter. I'm really an reluctant person where I look at everything before I make a decision. But so I applied to grad school, got accepted to Catholic University in D.C. and started, that was in May, I started grad school that August. So,
congratulations.
You know, did it online for 3.5 years and graduated in 2019 and got my clinical license last April.
So you got your clinical as well.
Yeah.
Where did you do your clinical hours?
I was working. My first job after grad school was working at an agency that does case management for adults with disabilities. So I was a case manager for a while. I was there almost 3 years and working with parents and adults with disabilities and trying to help them get the services that they need.
Okay. I just ask because, you know, getting those hours is a beast. And it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of money. And it's a process. So I am always curious to learn about people's experience with getting licensure. And
yeah, here in Michigan, I think there's 4,000. I believe it's 4,000 working hours after graduation,
yep.
And then you also need to do like 90 something hours of clinical supervision. So yep. Yeah, it's definitely. And then you have the national exam. So yep, that's quite a bit.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It is.
It's a lot. So, what did you think of school? Was it interesting to you? Was it boring? What did you think?
I loved grad school. Social work, grad school really opened my eyes to all the things I never saw growing up. Mm-hmm. So it exposed me to worldviews I had no clue about. Really helped me understand the way systems work. Helped me understand about inequality. I remember one of my first really conversations I had was my first class in grad school was on diversity, and I knew a little bit of what a question was like. So, you know, having a disability, you realize, you know, that things aren't equal. It's mm-hmm. It's not that hard to figure out. But when I heard about police brutality, I don't know, I never heard about this. I guess it's never crossed my mind. So I called a friend who grew up in Chicago, and we just, she just really told me a lot about what was going on. And I think once you see something, you can't unsee it. So so basically the worldview I grew up with began to really crumble, and that worldview began to strengthen and to see that there is systematic injustice. There is a lot of things that they're never taught that are there.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved grad school, and it was a really good experience for me.
Great. And now that you have your license, where has this brought you? What are you doing with this?
Currently, I work as a therapist and a primary care office in Detroit. And so after getting that clinical license last year, I was working in another agency that the job just wasn't going that great. I also started doing private practice on the side. Unfortunately, though, the private practice didn't take off like I wanted to, but it really showed me how much I love doing therapy and love being a therapist and love walking with people on their journey. So now mm-hmm. I work with people who it's a very underserved area. So just started that job in November and really enjoying it so far because it really allows me to work with doctors, with social workers, and we call it collaborative care. You're able to really see the whole person, and it's been a really, really neat experience so far.
So how long have you been working as a therapist?
Almost a year.
Congratulations, yeah. Will.
Yeah.
It's huge.
It is. And, it's huge. And I think what people don't realize is one of the things I've had to teach myself was that there, as you well know, there's so much when it comes to therapy. There's so many different modalities, there's different ways of doing things. And so the one thing I really had to teach myself was that, yeah, those things are good to know. You'll get there in time. The greatest thing you can ever do with your client is just be present with them in the moment in that therapy session. Because that therapy compliance will always be the most important thing with the people you work with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. 100%. And I am a therapist myself, stepping into a therapist role on this upcoming Monday. So I 100% get it. And I'm just so proud of you. Like, you have the word resiliency is really what I think of when I think of your story. And if there's any major takeaway that you'd like to give our listeners, what would that be?
I think there's several. I think the first would be that don't count people out because they're different. A lot of times people with disability are counted out. Like, there's times when, and I don't like doing this, but there's times you'll have to say, I went to grad school just to level the playing field, because people just have this perception that people who have a disability are cognitive impaired, or they're not as bright or brilliant, or whatever that might be. So don't count people out. The second thing I have to say is listen to people's stories. Like, not to offer advice, just take the time to listen to someone who's different than you. So often, we have a friend who is coming to us with something hard. In our minds, we're just thinking of five different things to do. When all they really want and need is for us just to be present. So show up and just shut up. Just be there with that person and offer them full acceptance. And the third thing I would say is, if you're out there and you're looking for a career change, or if you're saying, hey, I want to do this, but I'm not sure I can, you can. You absolutely can. Take those small steps and focus on every day, and you can make a difference. You can do what you want to do by taking those small steps. And so when I started grad school, I knew I was probably five years away from ever being a social worker or practicing, but I knew it was what I wanted to do, and I had a good support system that really helped me along that road. So those are the things I think I'll just encourage your listeners to do. But I think the biggest thing, though, too, is that if you need help, get help. Having depression, having anxiety doesn't mean you're abnormal, doesn't mean you've done something wrong. We all need help. We all need therapy. I started seeing a therapist about 7 months ago, and it's been life-changing. So we all need to take care of ourselves. And if you don't take care of yourself, no one else will.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on to Mental Health Uncovered. It means the world to me. And I think that your story is incredibly important. And I think that you have overcome so much. And I think that you're making a difference in people's lives every single day.
Thank you.
Your life is a walking example of what people can do in making changes that are proactive and that are proactive, resilient, and powerful. Like, it's so encouraging and uplifting to see. And so with that,
We said this earlier, but I can't emphasize this enough. You have to know your worth, because until you know your worth, you won't take those challenges. You won't take those risks. But once you know your worth, it changes everything.
Agreed. And with that, everyone, focus on your worth and have a wonderful day. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please remember that Mental Health Uncovered does not provide any type of therapeutic, clinical, psychiatric, or medical advice, and is intended for entertainment purposes only. If you need such care, I encourage you to find such a professional in your community. You can locate and access your local crisis line by calling 988. Thanks again for listening.